Cutting into the rock face of the mountain opposite, he carved out caves many stadia in length, and within them he made some rooms for banqueting and others for sleeping and daily life, and he brought in an abundance of running water, both for pleasure and as an ornament to the courtyard. The mouths of the caves he made narrow, so that only one person could pass through at a time, deliberately, as a safeguard against being besieged by his brothers and taken by surprise. He also built courtyards of extraordinary size, adorning them with very long garden parks. Having completed this place, he named it Tyre. This place lies between Arabia and Judea, across the Jordan, not far from the region of Heshbon. He ruled that district for 7 years, for the whole time that Seleucus reigned over Syria. When Seleucus died, his brother Antiochus, called Epiphanes, took the throne after him. Ptolemy, king of Egypt, likewise surnamed Epiphanes, also died, leaving two sons still young in years, of whom the elder was called Philometor and the younger Physcon. Hyacinus, seeing that Antiochus had great power and fearing that he might be seized and punished for what he had done to the Arabs, took his own life. Antiochus seized his entire estate. At about the same time, Onias the high priest also died, and Antiochus gave the high priesthood to his brother Jesus, since the son Onias had left behind was still an infant. We will describe what happened to this child in its proper place. Jesus, for this was the brother of Onias, was deprived of the high priesthood when the king grew angry with him and gave it to his youngest brother, named Onias. For Simon had had these three sons, and the high priesthood passed to all three in turn, as we have shown. Now Jesus renamed himself Jason, and Onias was called Menelaus. When the former high priest Jesus quarreled with Menelaus, who had been installed after him, the populace split into two factions. On Menelaus's side were the sons of Tobias, while the greater part of the people supported Jason. Hard-pressed by Jason, Menelaus and the sons of Tobias withdrew to Antiochus, informing him that they wished to abandon their ancestral laws and their form of government under them, and instead follow the king's laws and adopt the Greek way of life. They asked him, therefore, to permit them to build a gymnasium in Jerusalem. When he consented, they also concealed the circumcision of their private parts, so that even when stripped for exercise they might appear Greek, and abandoning all else that was ancestral to them, they imitated the practices of the other nations. Since his kingdom was proceeding according to his wishes, Antiochus resolved to march against Egypt, having conceived a desire for it, and because he held the sons of Ptolemy in contempt, since they were still weak and not yet capable of managing affairs of such magnitude. Coming with a large force to Pelusium, he outmaneuvered Ptolemy Philometor by trickery and seized Egypt, and having occupied the region around Memphis, he set out for Alexandria, intending to reduce it by siege and to overpower Ptolemy, who reigned there. But he was driven back not only from Alexandria, but from the whole of Egypt, the Romans having ordered him to keep away from the country, as we have already shown elsewhere. I will now relate in detail the affairs of this king, how he subdued Judea and the temple. For in my earlier work, I mentioned these matters only in summary, and I have thought it necessary now to return to a more precise account of them. Having withdrawn from Egypt out of fear of the Romans, King Antiochus marched against the city of Jerusalem, and arriving there in the 143rd year after the kings descended from Seleucus, he took the city without a fight, since those of his own party opened its gates to him. Once master of Jerusalem in this way, he killed many of those who held opposing views, and having plundered a great quantity of money, he returned to Antioch. 2 years later, in the 145th year, on the 25th day of the month called by us Excelius, and by the Macedonians Apuleius, in the 153rd Olympiad, it happened that the king went up to Jerusalem with a large force and, feigning peace, took the city by deceit. This time he spared not even those who had let him in, on account of the wealth in the temple, but out of greed, for he saw much gold in the sanctuary and the rest of the votive ornaments of great value, he set out to plunder it and endured. He stripped the temple bare, carrying off even the vessels of God, the golden lampstands, the golden altar, the table, and the sacrificial implements, not sparing even the curtains, which were made of fine linen and scarlet. He emptied out the hidden treasuries as well, leaving absolutely nothing behind, and so plunged the Jews into deep mourning. He also stopped them from offering the daily sacrifices they made to God under the law. And after plundering the whole city, he killed some of the inhabitants and took others captive, along with their wives and children, so that the number of those seized alive came to about 10,000. He burned the finest parts of the city, tore down its walls, and built a citadel in the lower city, since it stood high and overlooked the temple. Fortifying it with high walls and towers, he stationed a Macedonian garrison there. The impious and morally corrupt among the populace nevertheless kept living in the citadel, and through them the citizens suffered many terrible things. The king also built an altar over the altar of God and slaughtered pigs on it, performing a sacrifice neither lawful nor traditional in the religion of the Jews. He forced them to abandon the worship of their own God and instead venerate the gods he recognized, to build shrines and set up altars in every city and village, and to sacrifice pigs on them daily. He ordered them not to circumcise their children, threatening punishment on anyone found doing so contrary to his decree, and he appointed overseers to compel them to carry out his instructions. Many of the Jews went along with what the king had ordered, some willingly, others out of fear of the threatened punishment. But the most respected and noble in spirit paid no heed to him, valuing their ancestral customs more than the punishment he threatened against those who disobeyed. For this they were tortured and abused every day and died under bitter torments. Scourged and mutilated in body, they were crucified while still alive and breathing. And the wives and children of those who had circumcised their sons against the king's decree were strangled. The children hung from the necks of their own crucified parents. Wherever a sacred book or copy of the law was found, it was destroyed, and whoever was found possessing it perished miserably along with it. Seeing the Jews suffering these things, the Samaritans no longer admitted to being their kinsmen, nor did they call the temple on Gerizim a temple of the Most High God, acting true to their own nature, as we have shown, and claiming instead to be colonists of the Medes and Persians, which in fact they are. They sent envoys to Antiochus and delivered a letter to him reading as follows. To King Antiochus, God manifest, a petition from the Sidonians at Shechem. Our ancestors, on account of certain droughts in their country, and following an ancient superstition, made it their custom to honor the day called among the Jews the Sabbath, and they set up an unnamed temple on the mountain called Gerizim, where they offered the appropriate sacrifices. Now that you have dealt with the Jews as their wickedness deserves, the officials administering your affairs, supposing that we do the same things as they do because of kinship, attach the same charges to us, though we are in fact by origin Sidonians, as is plain from our public records. We therefore ask you, our benefactor and savior, to instruct Apollonius the district governor and Nicanor the administrator of royal affairs not to trouble us by attaching to us the charges leveled at the Jews, since we are foreign to them in both race and customs, and to have our unnamed temple named the Temple of Zeus of the Greeks. If this is done, we shall cease being troubled and shall attend to our own affairs in security, thereby increasing your revenues. In response to this petition of the Samaritans, the king wrote back to them as follows. King Antiochus to Nicanor, the Sidonians at Shechem have submitted the enclosed petition. Since when we deliberated on the matter with our friends, the envoys they sent made clear to us that they have nothing to do with the charges brought against the Jews, but choose instead to live by Greek customs, we hereby release them from those charges, and their temple, as they have requested, shall be named the Temple of Zeus of the Greeks. He sent the same instructions to Apollonius the district governor in the 46th year, on the 18th of the month Hecatombion, called Hyrcanus. At about this same time there lived in the village of Modin in Judea a man named Mattathias, son of John, son of Simeon, of the house of Hasmon, a priest of the division of Jorib, a Jeruzalemite. He had five sons, John called Gaddis, Simon called Thassi, Judas called Maccabeus, Eleazar called Oren, and Jonathan called Apis. Mattathias lamented to his children the state of affairs, the plundering of the city, the pillaging of the temple, and the calamities of the people, and told them it was better for them to die for the laws of their fathers than to go on living in such impiety. When those the king had appointed to compel the Jews to carry out his orders came to the village of Modin, and commanded the people there to sacrifice as the king had directed, they asked Mattathias to take the lead in the sacrifices, both because of his reputation on other grounds and because of the excellence of his sons, reasoning that the citizens would follow his example, and that he would thereby be honored by the king. But Mattathias said he would not do it, and that even if every nation obeyed the commands of Antiochus, whether out of fear or a wish to please him, he himself, together with his sons, would never be persuaded to forsake his ancestral worship. When he fell silent, one of the Jews stepped forward and, following Antiochus's orders, offered sacrifice in full view of everyone. Enraged, Mattathias rushed at him together with his sons, who carried short swords, and killed him, and along with him the king's officer Apelles, who had been enforcing the order, killing him too with the help of a few followers. He then tore down the altar and cried out, "Whoever is zealous for the customs of our fathers and for the worship of God, let him follow me." And with these words, he set out for the desert with his sons, leaving behind in the village everything he owned. Others did the same, fleeing with their children and wives into the desert and living in caves there. When the king's officers heard of this, they took the forces stationed in the citadel at Jerusalem and pursued the Jews into the desert. Upon overtaking them, they first tried to persuade them to reconsider and choose what was to their advantage, rather than force them into a position where they would have to be treated by the law of war. When the Jews would not accept these terms but held to their contrary resolve, the officers engaged them in battle on the day of the Sabbath and burned them in the caves just as they were, since they made no defense and did not even block the entrances, for they refrained from defending themselves out of regard for the day, unwilling even amid disaster to violate the honor due the Sabbath, on which, they said, it is our law to do no work. About 1,000 of them died in this way, suffocated in the caves along with their wives and children, but many survivors went over to Mattathias and made him their leader. He taught them to fight even on the Sabbath, telling them that if they did not do this while still observing the law, they would become their own worst enemies. For if the enemy attacked them on that day and they did not defend themselves, nothing would prevent all of them from being destroyed without a fight. By these words he persuaded them, and to this day the practice remains among us that, if ever necessary, fighting on the Sabbath is permitted. Having gathered a large force around himself, Mattathias tore down the pagan altars and put to death the transgressors wherever he was able to seize them, for many scattered out of caution into the surrounding nations. He also ordered the uncircumcised children to be circumcised, expelling those who had been appointed to prevent it. Having led for 1 year, Mattathias fell ill, and calling his sons to his side and gathering them around him, he said, "I, my children, am going the way appointed by fate, and I entrust to you my own resolve, urging you not to prove poor guardians of it, but remembering the purpose of the one who fathered and raised you, to preserve our ancestral customs and to restore our ancient way of life, now in danger of being lost, rather than fall in with those who, whether by choice or under compulsion, betray it. I ask you, my sons, to stand firm and rise above every act of violence and compulsion, preparing your souls in such a way that you are ready to die for the laws, if it should come to that, bearing in mind that the divine, seeing you so disposed, will not overlook you, but, admiring your virtue, will restore you to yourselves once more, and to the freedom in which you will live enjoying your own customs in security. Our bodies are mortal and perishable, but through the memory of noble deeds we attain a kind of immortality. It is this that I want you to love and pursue, true glory, and, in undertaking the greatest things, not to shrink from giving up your lives for them. Above all, I urge you to be of one mind, and where one of you is by nature superior to another in some respect, to yield to him and to make use of each other's particular strengths as your own. Regard your brother Simon, who excels in judgment, as a father, and follow whatever counsel he gives you, and let Maccabeus, for his courage and strength, be your general in war, for he will avenge our nation and fight off its enemies. Welcome also the just and God-fearing among the people, and increase their strength." Having said these things to his sons, and having prayed that God would be their ally and would restore to the people their own accustomed way of life, he died not long after, and was buried at Modin amid great mourning by the whole people. His son Judas, called Maccabeus, succeeded him as leader of affairs in the 146th year. With the eager support of his brothers and others, he drove the enemy from the land, put to death those of his own people who had transgressed the ancestral law, and cleansed the land of all defilement. When Apollonius, the general in Samaria, heard of this, he took his forces and set out against Judas. Judas met him in the field, engaged him in battle, and won, killing many of the enemy, including the general Apollonius himself, whose sword, which he had carried, Judas took as spoil and kept for his own use. He wounded still more of them, and after taking much plunder from the enemy's camp, he withdrew. Seron, the general of Celesyria, on hearing that many had gone over to Judas and that he had already gathered a considerable force fit for contests and wars, judged it right to march against him, thinking he ought to try to punish those who were transgressing the king's commands. Gathering whatever forces he had on hand, and adding to them the Jewish fugitives and the impious among the Jews, he advanced against Judas. Pressing on as far as the village of Beth-horon in Judea, he made camp there. Judas went out to meet him, intending to give battle. But when he saw that his soldiers hesitated to fight because of their small numbers and their lack of food, for they had been fasting, he encouraged them, telling them that victory and mastery over the enemy lay not in numbers but in piety toward the divine, and that their own ancestors offered the clearest proof of this, for by their justice and by fighting for their own laws and children, they had often defeated many tens of thousands, since to do no wrong is itself a mighty power. By these words he persuaded his men, despite the numbers of their opponents, to close with Seron, and in the engagement he routed the Syrians. For once their general had fallen, all of them rushed to flee, thinking their safety lay in that alone. Pursuing them as far as the plain, he killed about 800 of the enemy, while the rest escaped to the coast. On hearing of this, King Antiochus was greatly enraged at what had happened, and gathering all the forces of his own kingdom, and taking on a great many mercenaries from the islands as well, he prepared to invade Judea at the start of spring. But when, in the course of dividing out his army, he saw that his treasuries were running low and that there was a shortage of funds, since not all the tribute was being collected, owing to the revolts among the subject nations, and since, being generous and open-handed by nature, he was never satisfied with what he had, he decided to go first to Persia and collect the tribute of that region. Leaving in charge of affairs a certain Lysias, a man held in high regard by him, and entrusting to him the territory extending to the borders of Egypt and Lower Asia as far as the Euphrates River, together with part of his forces and his elephants, he instructed him to raise his son Antiochus with every care until his return, and, after subduing Judea and enslaving its inhabitants, to destroy Jerusalem and wipe out their entire people. Having given Lysias these instructions, King Antiochus set out for Persia in the 147th year, and after crossing the Euphrates, he went up to the satraps of the upper provinces. Lysias chose Ptolemy, son of Doraemenes, Nicanor, and Gorgias, capable men among the king's friends, and putting into their hands 40,000 infantry and 7,000 cavalry, sent them against Judea. They advanced as far as the city of Emmaus and made camp there on the plain. Allies joined them from Syria and the surrounding country, along with many of the Jewish fugitives, and even some merchants who came intending to buy up those who would be taken captive, bringing with them fetters to bind their prisoners and silver and gold to pay their price. When Judas observed the size of the camp and the multitude of the enemy, he urged his own soldiers to take courage, exhorting them, with their hopes of victory fixed on God, to entreat him in the manner of their ancestors, putting on sackcloth, to display this to God, and so persuade him to grant them mastery over their enemies. Having arranged them in the ancient, ancestral manner, by chiliarchs and taxiarchs, and having released the newly married and those who had recently acquired property, so that these men, clinging to life for the sake of enjoying it, might not fight less boldly, he took his stand and roused his own soldiers to the contest with words like these: "Comrades, no occasion could be more urgent than the present one for courage and contempt of danger. For now, by fighting bravely, you can recover your freedom, dear to all men for its own sake, but made still more desirable for you because it carries with it the right to worship God. Since you now stand in a position either to recover this freedom and regain the happy, blessed life you had under the laws and ancestral custom, or else to suffer the most shameful fate and leave not even a remnant of your race. Should the battle go badly, fight accordingly. Consider that death awaits you even if you do not fight, but believe that by winning victory for such great prizes, freedom, homeland, laws, piety, you will secure everlasting glory. So prepare your souls, as men who at daybreak tomorrow will meet the enemy. So Judas spoke, encouraging his army. Meanwhile, the enemy sent Gorgias with 5,000 infantry and 1,000 cavalry to fall upon Judas by night, having as guides for this some of the Jews who had deserted. But the son of Mattathias learned of it and himself resolved to fall upon the enemy's camp, especially since their force was divided. So, having taken supper at the proper hour and left many fires burning in his own camp, he marched all night against the enemy at Emmaus. Gorgias, not finding the enemy in their camp, but supposing they had withdrawn and hidden themselves in the mountains, set out to search for them, wherever they might be. About dawn, Judas appeared before the enemy at Emmaus with 3,000 men, poorly armed for want of means. And seeing the enemy superbly equipped and encamped with great professional skill, he urged his own men on, saying that God grants mastery over the many and the armed even to those who must fight with bare bodies, and admiring them for their courage, and he ordered the trumpeters to sound the signal. Then, falling upon the enemy unexpectedly and throwing their minds into confusion, he killed many who resisted, and pursuing the rest came as far as Gazara and the plains of Idumea and Azotus and Jamnia. About 3,000 of them fell. Judas urged his soldiers not to be eager for the spoils, telling them that a contest and battle still awaited them against Gorgias and the force with him, and that once they had mastered these as well, they would then plunder at their leisure, keeping only this in mind and expecting nothing else. While he was still saying this to his soldiers, Gorgias' men, peering out, saw that the force they had left in the camp had been routed and the camp itself burned, for the smoke, visible to them from a distance, made plain what had happened. When Gorgias' men learned how things stood and saw Judas' men ready for battle, they too took fright and fled. Judas, since Gorgias' soldiers had been beaten without a fight, turned back and gathered up the spoils, and taking much gold and silver and purple and violet cloth, returned home rejoicing and singing hymns to God for their success. For the victory contributed no small part to their freedom. Lysias, thrown into confusion by the defeat of the men he had sent, in the following year gathered 60,000 picked men, took 5,000 cavalry besides, and invaded Judea, and going up into the hill country encamped at Bethsura, a village of Judea. Judas met him with 10,000 men, and seeing the enemy's numbers, prayed that God would be his ally, and joining battle with the enemy's advance troops defeated them, killing about 5,000 of them, and became a terror to the rest. Lysias, observing the spirit of the Jews, that they were ready to die rather than live enslaved, and fearing their desperation as though it were strength, took the remainder of his force and withdrew to Antioch, where he spent his time recruiting mercenaries and preparing to invade Judea again with a larger army. With the generals of King Antiochus so many times defeated, Judas called an assembly and said that after the many victories God had given them, they ought to go up to Jerusalem, purify the temple, and offer the customary sacrifices. When he arrived with the whole multitude at Jerusalem, he found the temple deserted, its gates burned down, and plants growing wild in the sanctuary because of the desolation. He began to mourn with his own men, overcome at the sight of the temple. Choosing some of his soldiers, he ordered them to make war on the men guarding the citadel, until he himself should have purified the temple. Having cleansed it with care, he brought in new vessels, a lampstand, a table, an altar of incense, all made of gold, hung up the curtains of the doors and set the doors themselves in place, and taking down the altar of burnt offering, built a new one of unhewn stones not cut by iron. On the 25th of the month Xanthicus, which the Macedonians call Apuleios, they lit the lamps on the lampstand, burned incense on the altar, set loaves upon the table, and offered whole burnt offerings on the new altar. It happened that this took place on the very day on which, 3 years before, their holy worship had lapsed into profanation and common use. For the temple, laid waste by Antiochus, remained in that state for 3 years. These events at the temple took place in the 145th year, on the 25th of the month Apuleios, in the 153rd Olympiad. and it was rededicated on the same day, the 25th of the month Apuleius, in the 148th year, in the 154th Olympiad. The desolation of the temple came about, in accordance with Daniel's prophecy, 408 years before it happened, for he had foretold that the Macedonians would destroy it. Judas celebrated with his fellow citizens the recovery of the temple sacrifices for 8 days, omitting no form of pleasure, feasting them with lavish and splendid sacrifices, honoring God with hymns and psalms while delighting the people. So great was the pleasure they took in the renewal of their customs, coming to them unexpectedly after so long a time, once they found themselves in possession of the right to worship, that they made it a law for those who came after them to celebrate the recovery of the temple rites for 8 days. From that time to this, we keep the festival, calling it lights, because, I think, this freedom shone upon us beyond our hopes, and so they gave the festival this name. He also walled the city all around, and to guard against enemy raids, built high towers and stationed garrisons in them. He also fortified the town of Bethsura, so that it might serve them as a stronghold against attacks from the enemy. With these things thus accomplished, the surrounding nations, resentful at the revival and growing strength of the Jews, formed many conspiracies, and, gaining the upper hand through ambushes and plots, destroyed them. Judas, waging continual wars against these nations, tried to check their raids and the harm they were doing the Jews. He fell upon the sons of Esau, the Idumeans, in the region of Acrabbatene, killed many of them, and took spoil. He also shut in and besieged the sons of Bonus, who had been lying in wait for the Jews, burning their towers and destroying the men. From there he set out against the Ammonites, who had a large and populous force under the command of Timotheus. Having overpowered these as well, he took the city of Jazer by storm, and, taking their women and children captive and burning the city, returned to Judea. When the neighboring nations learned that he had gone back, they gathered in Gilead against the Jews within their borders. These Jews took refuge in the fortress of Dathema and sent word to Judas that Timotheus was eager to capture the place to which they had fled. While these letters were being read, messengers also arrived from Galilee reporting that the people of Ptolemais, Tyre, Sidon, and the other nations of Galilee had banded together. Considering, then, what must be done to meet both these reported needs, Judas ordered his brother Simon to take about 3,000 picked men and go to the help of the Jews in Galilee, while he himself, with his other brother Jonathan, set out for Gilead with 8,000 soldiers. He left Joseph son of Zacharias and Azarias in charge of the remaining forces, instructing them to guard Judea carefully and to engage no one in battle until his own return. Simon, arriving in Galilee and engaging the enemy, put them to flight and pursued them to the gates of Ptolemais, killing about 3,000 of them, and taking the spoils of the slain, along with the captive Jews and their baggage, he returned home. Judas Maccabeus and his brother Jonathan crossed the Jordan River, and after a 3 days' march from it, met the Nabataeans, who received them peaceably. When these told them of the plight of the Jews in Gilead, how many of them were suffering, shut up in the fortresses and towns of Gilead, and urged him to hasten against the foreigners and try to save their countrymen from them, Judas was persuaded and turned back into the desert, and, falling first upon the inhabitants of Bassora, took the city, killed every male able to bear arms, and set the city on fire. Even when night fell, he did not stop, but marched on through it to the fortress where the Jews were shut in, which Timotheus with his force was besieging, and arrived there at dawn. Finding the enemy already attacking the walls, some with ladders for scaling them, others bringing up siege engines, he ordered the trumpeter to sound the signal, and, urging his soldiers to risk themselves eagerly for their brothers and kinsmen, divided the army into three parts and fell upon the enemy from the rear. Timotheus' men, perceiving that it was Maccabeus, having already had experience of his courage and his success in war, took to flight, and Judas, pursuing with his army, killed about 8,000 of them. Turning aside to a city called Mela, belonging to the foreigners, he took this too, killed all the males, and burned the city. Setting out from there, he subdued Chasphemaic and Bosser and many other cities of Gilead. Not long afterward, Timotheus, having assembled a large force and taken on other allies, including some Arabs whom he had persuaded with pay to join his campaign, came leading his army to the far side of the torrent opposite Raphon, for this was a city, and urged his soldiers, if they should engage the Jews in battle, to fight eagerly and prevent them from crossing the torrent, telling them that defeat awaited them if the Jews crossed. Judas, hearing that Timotheus had made ready for battle, took his whole force and hastened against the enemy. Crossing the torrent, he fell upon them, killed those who came to meet him, and throwing the rest into terror, forced them to throw down their weapons and flee. Some of them escaped, while others fled for refuge into the precinct called Egrinai, hoping to find safety there. Judas, taking the town, killed them and burned the precinct, using various means to bring about the enemy's destruction. Having accomplished this, and gathered together the Jews in Gilead with their children and wives and their belongings, he was ready to lead them back to Judea. When he came to a certain city named Ephron lying on the road, and he could neither turn aside and go another way, nor did he wish to turn back, he sent to the people in it, asking them to open the gates and allow him to pass through the city, for they had blocked the gates with stones and cut off the passage. When the people of Ephron would not agree, he roused his men, surrounded the town, besieged it, and after pressing the siege day and night, took the city, killing every male in it and burning it entirely, and so won his way through. So great was the number of the slain that one had to walk over the corpses themselves. Crossing the Jordan, they came to the great plain facing the city called Bethshan, known to the Greeks as Scythopolis. Setting out from there, they arrived in Judea, singing psalms and hymns and performing the customary games of victory celebrations, and offered thank offerings both for their successes and for the safety of the army, for not one of the Jews died in these wars. Joseph, son of Zacharias and Azarias, whom Judas had left as commanders at the time when Simon was in Galilee, fighting the people of Ptolemais, and Judas himself, with his brother Jonathan, was in Gilead, wished to win a reputation of their own as capable commanders in war, and took the force under their command and came to Jamnia. Gorgias, the general of Jamnia, met them, and in the engagement they lost 2,000 of their force and, fleeing, were pursued to the borders of Judea. This setback befell them, they had disobeyed the orders Judas had sent them, not to engage anyone in battle before his own arrival. Beyond his other feats of generalship, one might well marvel at how he foresaw the defeat that Joseph and Azarias would suffer, understanding that it would follow if they departed at all from his instructions. Judas and his brothers, meanwhile, kept up their war against the Idumeans without relenting. They pressed them from every side, took the city of Hebron and tore down whatever was fortified in it, burned its towers, and ravaged the territory of the foreigners, including the city of Marissa. They also came to Azotus, took it, and plundered it. Then, carrying off much spoil and plunder, they returned to Judea. At about this same time, King Antiochus, advancing through the upper country, heard that there was a city in Persia called Elymais, renowned for its wealth, and that it had a costly temple of Artemis in it, full of dedications of every kind, and moreover arms and breastplates which, he was told, Alexander, king of the Macedonians and son of Philip, had left behind. Stirred by this report, he set out for Elymais, attacked it, and laid siege to it. But the people inside were not frightened by his assault or his siege. They held out stubbornly and dashed his hopes, driving him back from the city and sallying out after him in pursuit, so that he fled to Babylon, having lost much of his army. While he was grieving over this failure, some brought him word as well of the defeat of the generals he had left behind to fight the Jews, and of the growing strength of the Jewish nation. Weighed down now by this added worry on top of the first, he fell into a despondency so overwhelming that he sank into illness. As the illness dragged on and his sufferings increased, he realized he was going to die, and he called his friends together. He told them plainly that his illness was severe, and he made clear that he was suffering this because he had wronged the Jewish nation, plundering their temple and showing contempt for their God. And with these words, he breathed his last. So it is that Polybius of Megalopolis, a trustworthy writer, expresses astonishment at this. He says Antiochus died because he had intended to plunder the temple of Artemis in Persia, as though merely resolving on a deed he never carried out deserved such punishment. But if Polybius supposes that this is why Antiochus met his end in this way, it is far more likely that the king died on account of his sacrilege against the temple in Jerusalem. On this point, however, I have no quarrel, I hold as true the very cause that the writer from Megalopolis names. Before he died, Antiochus summoned Philip, one of his companions, and appointed him regent of the kingdom, giving him the diadem, the robe, and the signet ring, with orders to carry these to his son Antiochus and deliver them to him, and he asked Philip to look after the boy's upbringing and to keep the kingdom safe for him. Antiochus died in the 149th year. Lysias announced his death to the people and proclaimed the king's son, whose care he himself had as king, calling him Antiochus Eupator. At this same time, the garrison in the citadel of Jerusalem, along with Jewish exiles, did the Jews great harm. Whenever people went up to the temple wishing to sacrifice, the garrison would suddenly rush out and kill them, for the citadel overlooked the temple. Because of what was happening to them, Judas resolved to destroy the garrison, and gathering the whole people, he laid a determined siege to those in the citadel. This was the 150th year of the Seleucid era. He built siege engines and raised earthworks, and pressed the assault on the citadel with great diligence. Many of the exiles inside, however, slipped out by night, gathered some other impious men like themselves, and went to King Antiochus. They protested that they should not be looked down upon while suffering terribly at the hands of their own countrymen, and enduring this on account of his father, who had put an end to their ancestral religion, while they themselves had clung to what he had commanded in its place. They said the citadel and the garrison the king had stationed there were in danger of being taken by Judas and his men, unless help were sent from him. Hearing this, the young Antiochus grew angry, summoned his commanders and friends, and ordered them to gather mercenaries and all in the kingdom of military age. An army was assembled, about 100,000 foot soldiers, 20,000 horsemen, and 32 elephants. Taking up this force, he marched out from Antioch with Lysias in overall command of the whole army. Arriving in Idumea, he went up from there to Bethsura, a city very strong and hard to capture, and encircling it, laid siege to the town. The people of Bethsura resisted vigorously and burned the siege equipment he had prepared, for they sallied out against him, so that much time was spent on the siege. Judas, hearing of the king's advance, gave up his siege of the citadel, and going out to meet the king, pitched camp at the pass in a place called Bethsicaria, 70 stads from the enemy. The king set out from Bethsura and led his force to the pass, to the camp of Judas, and at daybreak drew up his army for battle. Because of the narrowness of the terrain, which did not allow them to be arranged abreast, he made the elephants follow one another in single file, and around each elephant advanced 1,000 foot soldiers and 500 horsemen. The elephants carried tall towers and archers. The rest of the force he had climbed the hills on either side, with friendly troops posted in front. He ordered the army to raise a war cry and attack the enemy, bearing the golden and bronze shields so that a brilliant gleam shone from them. The hills echoed with the shouting of the men. Seeing this, Judas was not dismayed, and receiving the enemy bravely, he killed about 600 of their frontline troops. His brother Eleazar, also called Oren, saw the tallest of the elephants armored in royal trappings, and thinking the king was riding on it, charged at it with great courage. He killed many of those around the elephant and scattered the rest, then crept in beneath its belly, struck it, and killed the beast, but it fell on top of Eleazar as it collapsed and crushed him beneath its weight. So he, having bravely destroyed many of the enemy, ended his life in this manner. Judas, seeing the strength of the enemy, withdrew to Jerusalem and prepared for a siege. Antiochus sent part of his army to Bethsura to besiege it, while he himself came to Jerusalem with the rest of the force. The people of Bethsura, terrified by his strength and seeing their provisions running short, surrendered themselves, taking oaths that they would suffer no harm from the king. Antiochus, on taking the city, did them no other injury, but only sent them out stripped of their possessions and set his own garrison in the city. For a long time he besieged the temple in Jerusalem, while those within defended themselves stubbornly. For every siege engine the king set up against them, they built a counter device in turn. But food failed them, since the produce that existed had been used up, and the land had not been farmed that year because it was the sabbatical year, in which our law requires the land to be left fallow, unsown. Many of the besieged accordingly deserted because of the shortage of necessities, so that only a few were left in the temple. Such, then, was the state of affairs for those besieged in the temple. Lysias the general and the king, when word reached them that Philip had come back from Persia and was setting things in order to seize power for himself, resolved to abandon the siege and march against Philip, but decided not to make this known to the soldiers and officers. Instead, the king ordered Lysias to address him and the officers publicly, saying nothing about Philip, but pointing out that the siege was proving very long, that the place was strongly fortified, that their supplies were already failing, that there was much business in the kingdom needing attention, and that it seemed far better to make a truce with the besieged, to grant friendship to their whole nation, and to allow them to live by their ancestral laws, the laws whose loss had driven them to war, and then to march home. When Lysias said this, both the army and the officers were pleased with the proposal. So the king sent to Judas and those besieged with him, offering peace and permission to live by their ancestral laws. They received the offer gladly, and taking oaths and pledges, came out of the temple. But when Antiochus entered it and saw how strongly fortified the place was, he broke his oaths and ordered his troops to come forward and level the wall to the ground. Having done this, he returned to Antioch, taking with him the high priest Onias, who was also called Menelaus. For Lysias had advised the king to put Menelaus to death, if he wished the Jews to remain quiet and cause him no further trouble, since it was Menelaus who had begun all the trouble by persuading the king's father to force the Jews to abandon their ancestral religion. So the king sent Menelaus to Berea in Syria and had him killed there, after he had held the high priesthood for 10 years, having proved wicked and impious, and having forced his own people to transgress their own laws so that he himself might rule the nation. After Menelaus's death, Alcimus, also called Jasimus, became high priest. King Antiochus, seeing that Philip was now in control of affairs, made war on him, took him prisoner, and put him to death. Now Onias, son of the high priest, the boy we mentioned earlier as having been left behind, still a child, when his father died, seeing that the king had killed his uncle Menelaus and given the high priesthood to Alcimus, who was not of the priestly line, but had been persuaded by Lysias to transfer the honor from that family to another house, fled to Ptolemy, king of Egypt. Being honored by Ptolemy and his wife Cleopatra, he obtained a place he had requested in the Heliopolite district, and there built a temple resembling the one in Jerusalem. We shall have a better occasion to discuss this later. At about this same time, Demetrius, son of Seleucus, fled from Rome and, seizing Tripolis in Syria, put the diadem on himself. Gathering some mercenaries around him, he entered upon the kingdom, and everyone gladly received him and gave themselves over to him. They seized King Antiochus and Lysias alive and brought them to him. On Demetrius's order, these two were put to death at once, Antiochus having reigned 2 years, as has already been noted elsewhere. Many wicked Jews and exiles banded together and went to Demetrius, and with them Alcimus the high priest. They accused the whole nation, and Judas and his brothers in particular, saying that Judas had killed all of Demetrius's friends and all those in the kingdom who favored him and were waiting for him, and had driven them from their own land, making them exiles in a foreign country. They asked him to send one of his own friends to learn for himself what deeds Judas and his men had dared to commit. Demetrius, provoked, sent out Bacchides, a friend of King Antiochus Epiphanes, an honest man entrusted with the whole of Mesopotamia, giving him an army and placing the high priest Alcimus in his charge, with orders to kill Judas and those with him. Bacchides set out from Antioch with his forces, and on arriving in Judea sent word to Judas and his brothers, speaking of friendship and peace, for he wished to take Judas by treachery. Judas did not trust him, for he saw that he had come with so large an army as one brings to war, not to peace. Some of the people, however, gave heed to what Bacchides proclaimed, and thinking they would suffer no harm from Alcimus, since he was one of their own countrymen, went over to him, and after taking oaths from both sides that neither they nor those of like mind would suffer harm, entrusted themselves to him. But Bacchides, disregarding the oaths, killed 60 of them, while as for the others who meant to come over to him, he turned back the pledge of good faith he had given the first. When he left Jerusalem and came to a village called Bethsetho, he sent men who seized many of the deserters and some of the people, and after killing all of them, ordered everyone in the region to obey Alcimus. Leaving him with some troops to keep hold of the territory, Bacchides returned to King Demetrius at Antioch. Alcimus, wishing to secure his position and understanding that he would rule more safely if he won the goodwill of the people, drew everyone over with agreeable words, treating each man with pleasant and gracious speech, and very quickly gathered a large body of supporters and forces. Most of these were drawn from the Impius and the exiles, and using them as his agents and soldiers, he went through the country and put to death all those he found there who favored Judas's cause. Seeing that Alcimus was now growing powerful and had destroyed many of the good and pious men of the nation, Judas in turn went through the country and put to death those who shared Alcimus's views. Alcimus, seeing that he was unable to hold his own against Judas, but was being overpowered by his strength, decided to turn to King Demetrius for aid, and going to Antioch, he provoked the king against Judas, accusing him of having done him many injuries already and warning that there would be more still, unless he were forestalled and made to pay the penalty by the dispatch of a strong force against him. Demetrius, thinking it now dangerous for his own affairs to overlook Judas. Into such strength, Demetrius sent out Nicanor, the most loyal and trusted of his friends. This was the man who had fled to Rome together with him, and gave him as large a force as he judged sufficient against Judas, ordering him to show the nation no mercy whatsoever. When Nicanor arrived at Jerusalem, he decided not to fight Judas outright, but resolved instead to get him into his power by deceit. He sent him peaceful proposals, saying there was no need for war and danger, and offering him oaths that he would suffer no harm. He had come, he said, with friends in order to make plain to them King Demetrius's true disposition toward their people. When Nicanor had negotiated in this way, Judas and his brothers were persuaded, and suspecting no trickery, exchanged pledges with him and received Nicanor and his force. Nicanor greeted Judas, and in the midst of conversing with him, gave his own men a signal to seize him. But Judas, perceiving the plot, sprang away and fled back to his own men. Once his intent and the ambush were exposed, Nicanor resolved to make war on Judas. He mustered and equipped his forces for battle and engaged Judas near a village called Capharsalama, and having won the victory, forced Judas to flee to the citadel in Jerusalem. As Judas was coming down from the citadel to the temple, some of the priests and elders met him, greeted him, and showed him the sacrifices they said they were offering to God on the king's behalf. Nicanor cursed them and threatened that, unless the people handed Judas over to him, he would tear down the temple upon his return. Having made this threat, he left Jerusalem, and the priests broke into tears from grief at what had been said, and begged God to deliver them from their enemies. When Nicanor had left Jerusalem, he reached a village called Bethhoron and encamped there, having been joined by another force from Syria. Judas encamped at Adasa, another village 30 stads from Bethhoron, with 2,000 soldiers. He urged them not to be terrified by the enemy's numbers, nor to calculate how many they were about to fight, but to consider instead who they were, and for what prizes they were risking their lives, and so to go boldly to meet the enemy. He led them out to battle and engaged Nicanor, and after a hard-fought battle he defeated the enemy, killing many of them, and at last Nicanor himself fell, fighting gloriously to the end. Once he had fallen, his army did not stand its ground either, but having lost their general they turned to flight, throwing away their weapons. Judas pursued and slaughtered them, and signaled with trumpets to the surrounding villages that he was defeating the enemy. Those in the villages, hearing this, rushed out armed, and meeting the fugitives face to face, cut them down, so that not one of the 9,000 men in that battle escaped. This victory came about on the 13th of the month called Adar by the Jews and Distros by the Macedonians. They celebrate this day every year as a festival of victory. From that time, for a little while, the Jewish nation rested from war and enjoyed peace, before again being plunged into struggles and dangers. Alcimus the high priest wished to tear down the wall of the sanctuary, which was ancient and had been built by the prophets of old, but a sudden stroke from God fell upon him. He was struck speechless and cast to the ground, and after being tormented for many days he died, having served as high priest for 4 years. When he died, the people gave the high priesthood to Judas, who, hearing of the power of the Romans, that they had conquered Gaul, Spain, and Carthage in Libya, and had subdued Greece besides, along with the kings Perseus, Philip, and Antiochus the Great, resolved to make an alliance of friendship with them. He sent to Rome his friends Eupolmus, son of John, and Jason, son of Eleazar, asking them to secure for him an alliance and friendship, and to have the Romans write to Demetrius not to make war on the Jews. When Judas's envoys arrived in Rome, the Senate received them, and after debating the purpose of their mission, granted the alliance. Having passed a decree on the matter, the Senate sent a copy of it to Judea and had the original inscribed on bronze tablets and set up on the Capitol. It read as follows: A decree of the Senate concerning alliance and friendship with the nation of the Jews. No one subject to Rome is to make war on the Jewish nation, nor to supply grain, ships, or money to those who make war on them. If anyone attacks the Jews, the Romans are to help them as far as possible. And likewise, if anyone attacks Roman territory, the Jews are to fight alongside them as allies. And if the Jewish nation should wish to add anything to or remove anything from this alliance, this is to be done by common consent of the Roman people, and whatever is added shall be binding. This decree was written by Eupolmus, son of John, and Jason, son of Eleazar, in the high priesthood of Judas over the nation and the generalship of his brother Simon. Thus it was that the first friendship and alliance between Rome and the Jews came about. When Demetrius was informed of Nicanor's death and the destruction of the force with him, he again sent out Bacchides with an army into Judea. Setting out from Antioch and arriving in Judea, Bacchides encamped at Arbela, a city of Galilee, and besieged those who were in the caves there. For many had taken refuge in them, captured them, and then set out from there in haste for Jerusalem. Learning that Judas was encamped in a village called Bezeth, he hastened against him with 20,000 infantry and 2,000 cavalry. Judas had only 1,000 men in all. Seeing the size of Bacchides's force, these men were afraid, and all but 800 abandoned the camp and fled. Left behind by his own soldiers, with the enemy pressing upon him and allowing him no time to gather more troops, Judas was forced to face Bacchides's forces with only the 800. Urging them to bear the danger bravely, he called on them to go into battle. When they said they were not a match for so great an army, and advised that they withdraw for now to save themselves, and later gather their own men together to engage the enemy, he said, "May the sun never look down on such a thing happening, that I should show my back to the enemy. Even if the present hour brings my death, and I must die fighting no matter what, I will stand my ground nobly, enduring whatever is to come, rather than bring upon my past achievements and their renown the disgrace of this present flight." Having said this to those who remained, disdaining the danger, he urged them to go and meet the enemy. Bacchides led his forces out of camp and drew them up for battle, stationing his cavalry on each wing and placing his light troops and archers in front of the whole phalanx, while he himself commanded the right wing. Having arrayed his army in this way, when he approached the enemy's camp, he ordered the trumpeter to sound the signal, and the army advanced with a battle cry. Judas did the same and engaged the enemy, and as both sides fought fiercely and the battle dragged on until sunset, Judas saw that Bacchides and the strongest part of the army were on the right wing, and taking his bravest men, he charged that part of the line, and attacking those there, broke apart their formation. Pushing into the midst of them, he forced them to flee, and pursued them as far as the mountain called Azza. But those on the left wing, seeing the rout of the men on the right, surrounded Judas as he pursued, coming up behind him and hemming him in. Unable to flee but surrounded by the enemy, he stood his ground and fought together with those beside him. He killed many of his opponents, but utterly worn out, he too fell, ending his life amid successes like those he had achieved before. When Judas fell, those with him, having no one left to look to and bereft of such a general, fled. Simon and Jonathan, Judas's brothers, obtained his body from the enemy under truce and brought it to the village of Modin, where their father too had been buried, and they buried him there, the people mourning him for many days and honoring him together according to custom. Such was the end that overtook Judas, a man of noble spirit who had proved a great warrior, mindful of his father Mattathias's commands, and who had endured all things, both doing and suffering, for the freedom of his countrymen. Being such a man in valor, he left behind the greatest renown and monument of himself, having freed his nation and rescued it from slavery under the Macedonians. He died having held the high priesthood for 3 years.